Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 245 of the Fun with Cars Formula One podcast. I'm Robin Warner, and today I'm joined by the man some call the Hamilton heartthrob. That's right, this is a very sexy man, Chris Roche. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Robin, how are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. Would you put Hamilton in stalker status, or is it still amicable?
He's not a stalker of me, no.
Okay. Today we're going to talk about the Japanese, United States, and Mexican Grand Prix, which were the 17th, 18th, and 19th round of the Formula One Championship. And in a rare occurrence, I'm alone in the house, and it sounds like Chris has his family right by his side.
Yes, it's a full house, and Will has just departed, so we might get some peace and quiet.
Oh, well, I'll keep my fingers crossed. You hold your breath. For a full schedule of all four series, go to funwithcars.com/schedules. Excuse me, schedules. It is Tuesday
evening. Schedules works.
Yeah, well, you know. It is Tuesday evening, November 6th. And here are the results of the Japanese, U.S., and Mexican Grand Prix. Yes, I'm going to go through all three flawlessly, I have no doubt. In Japan, wouldn't you know it, it was Lewis Hamilton in the leading Mercedes, followed by Valtteri Bottas in the second Mercedes. Third place went to Max Verstappen in the leading Red Bull. Fourth place went to Daniel Ricciardo in the second Red Bull. Fifth place went to Kimi Raikkonen in the top Ferrari. Sixth place went to Sebastian Vettel in the second Ferrari. And those results do not reflect the actual racing that went on. Seventh place was the top Force India with Sergio Perez. Eighth place, the top Haas Ferrari, Romain Grosjean. Ninth place, Esteban Ocon in the second Force India. And tenth place, collecting the final point, was Carlos Sainz in the top Renault. 11th place went to Pierre Gasly in the Toro Rosso Honda. 12th, Marcus Ericsson in the top Sauber Ferrari. Brendan Hartley was 13th in the second Toro Rosso. And 14th went to Fernando Alonso in the lead McLaren. 15th, Stoffel Vandoorne in the second McLaren. And here we go again. 16th went to Sergei Sorokin in the lead Williams. 17th, Lance Stroll in the second Williams. Three cars did not finish the race. That was Charles Leclerc in the second Sauber, Nico Hülkenberg in the second Renault, and Kevin Magnussen in the second Ferrari. On to the United States, which was the best race of the season for a myriad of reasons. And no, I'm not biased. It is because Kimi Raikkonen won in the lead Ferrari, followed by Max Verstappen in the lead Red Bull racing car. Then Lewis Hamilton in the lead Mercedes was third. Sebastian Vettel managed fourth in the second Ferrari. Valtteri Bottas fifth in the second Mercedes. Nico Hülkenberg was the top Renault in sixth place, followed by his teammate Carlos Sainz in seventh. Esteban Ocon was eighth in the lead Force India, and Kevin Magnussen ninth in the lead Haas Ferrari, except those two were disqualified according to the official results here. So that means that Sergio Perez was eighth in the Force India Mercedes, and Brendan Hartley was ninth in the Scuderia Toro Rosso. That's right, Brendan Hartley scored some points, although Brendan was a lap down. 10th place went to Marcus Ericsson in the, I don't know if that's first Sauber Ferrari. 11th place, Stoffel Vandoorne in the first McLaren Renault. 12th place went to Pierre Gasly in the second Toro Rosso. 13th to Sergei Sorokin in the first in the lead Williams, followed by his teammate Lance Stroll in the second Williams. Okay, the rest of the drivers were not classified. That was again Charles Leclerc in the Sauber Ferrari, Daniel Ricciardo in the Red Bull Racing, Romain Grosjean in the Haas Ferrari, and Fernando Alonso in the McLaren. Okay, last but certainly not least, the championship deciding event at the Mexican Grand Prix, and that went to Max Verstappen. Max Verstappen got a race win in the Red Bull Racing car. He was followed by Sebastian Vettel in the lead Ferrari and his teammate Kimi Raikkonen in the second Ferrari, who's still the best driver in the world. Lewis Hamilton finished fourth in the lead Mercedes, but he also did kind of okay in another category, which I'm sure we'll get to. He was followed by his teammate Valtteri Bottas in the second Mercedes. Sixth place, kind of becoming His home away from home. Sixth place, Nico Hülkenberg in the Renault. Seventh place, Charles Leclerc finished the race and was the lead Sauber Ferrari. Eighth place went to Stoffel Vandoorne in the lean McLaren. Ninth place was the second Sauber Ferrari, Marcus Ericsson, who, by the way, is IndyCar bound next year. 10th place, Pierre Gasly, Scuderia Toro Rosso, and scoring another point. Good for him, but two laps down. 11th place, Esteban Ocon in the lead Force India. 12th place, Lance Stroll in the lead Williams, followed by his teammate Sergei Sorokin in 13th. 14th went to Brendan Hartley in the second Toro Rosso. 15th, Kevin Magnussen in the Haas Ferrari. 16th, Romain Grosjean in the second Haas Ferrari. And then the rest of these guys were not classified, and that was Daniel Ricciardo in the Red Bull Racing. Sergio Perez in the Force India, Carlos Sainz in the second Renault, and Fernando Alonso in the McLaren. I feel like I was repeating myself there a lot, but that actually wasn't. Those were three different race results, even though there were a lot of overlap there. But the one thing I do want to say, it was three races that we're covering and three different winners, and I think that's a good start.
I agree. And, of course, you haven't given us the rundown of the championship. Did anyone win the world title?
Not that I can recall. You know, the Constructors' Championship is still alive. And,
yes, it is.
And it is going to be a nail-biter. And, that's it. That's it. I mean, so we've covered the race results. The best driver in the world, Kimi Raikkonen, won. I guess there's nothing much else to say.
How nervous were you then at the closing of the US Grand Prix when Kimi was literally clinging on by his fingernails?
I was waiting for the radio transmission to come in and be like, Kimi, drop out of lean, go down to fifth or whatever it is, so Sebastian Vettel could be up one more place. and let Max Verstappen win this one. It would not have been the most surprising thing I'd seen from Ferrari. I'll put it that way. But no, Kimi Raikkonen had gone a whole season without being able to move up a position on the first lap. He did so at the U.S. Grand Prix. He went to second to first, had a great start, held off Lewis Hamilton, and more or less, not exactly so, but more or less carried on in the lead from that point on. And drove brilliantly, and it was great. And he was hysterical in the post-race interviews. He's like, yeah, my fans are probably happier than I am. For me, it's the same. it's like, well, it can't be. Come on. I mean, to a certain extent, he had to be lying, but whatever.
It's that cool Finnish demeanor. You know, can't break it for a moment. No, he did a great race. I mean, he executed perfectly off the start. Was pretty feisty in his defense when Lewis caught him after Lewis had made his early stop under the safety car, and then comfortably held off Max really at the end. So no, full credit to him. Delivered a good Ferrari win, which is something his teammate has struggled to do recently.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of amazing if you look at the earlier results. You know, the first half of the season. You know, we had Sebastian Vettel win the first two races, and we had Sebastian Vettel win again in Canada. You know, he was consistently there. He was at or near the front. He was doing really well. He had, gosh, I have to double check here. He had 1, 2, 3 wins when Hamilton only had two. And then the second half of the season, boy, did it ever fall apart. And that's kind of what I want to get to in Japan, where Vettel just made one mistake after the other. I mean, he crashed and spun twice in the first, 5, 6 laps? It was incredible.
Well, yeah, I mean, he made a mistake. I mean, Ferrari and Vettel made mistakes in qualifying, right? They went out on the inters at the start of Q3, which put him on the back foot. He had a chance to do a run when the conditions were still decent, and dropped the ball at Spoon, or dropped the egg at Spoon, maybe. and uh,
Something was dropped at Spoon.
Something was dropped at Spoon. So, you know, and it in the race, he made up the places pretty competently for the first couple of laps. But then, you know, it's always going to be asking for trouble diving down the inside at that corner with Max Verstappen. And so it proved, you know, there's been a lot of analysis made of the fact that Vettel has come off worst in three on-track incidents where he's been the car on the inside and probably should have been, you know, the one to actually get away with the wheel-to-wheel contact and yet has ended up spinning. So, you know, his racecraft hasn't looked tremendous the last few races, with the exception, I think he did all right in Mexico, to be fair to him. But prior to that, he was looking pretty shabby. And, you know, it just proved to be the final nail in the coffin for his championship hopes, isn't it, really?
Yeah, Japan just really, it was already not looking good, but Japan really put an exclamation point on it. And I was just gobsmacked that the performance was where it was. And there's been these reports about Charles Leclerc was actually kind of a rebuke of Sebastian Vettel, and that Leclerc is going to keep him on his toes in these things. And then you see him performing, and I can only surmise that at some level Vettel is under just immense pressure. Now, whether this entirely self-inflicted or it is partially coming from the team, that's the only thing I can't say with a lot of confidence.
Well, Ferrari didn't help matters, did they? They lost their way a little bit. They came with an aggressive aero update, and it didn't work, and they had to revert back to an older specification for a couple of races, and they finally seem to have got on top of that. You know, Mexico, but that's at least one race. Well, I guess you could argue Austin too, but that was at least still a race too late. And it's eerily similar to last season. You know, I mean, Ferrari and Vettel were looking so good up to the summer break, and then it disintegrated after that. And the same, with possible exception of the Belgian performance, has been true this year. You know, Hamilton does seem to be extremely tough to beat in this series of races. Although, you know, he had a pretty ordinary Austin and Mexico by his standards. But yeah, he's a formidable competitor after the summer break. It must be that 2 weeks on the beach just supercharges him or something, because, you know, he's been on another level relative to Bottas as well, with the odd exception.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. I think that, you know, legendary status and remember this for decades, that kind of talk, that kind of hyperbole, and maybe it's not hyperbole, but that kind of extreme talk was becoming more and more common for what Hamilton was pulling off here. And, you know, we're talking about, as we're going, someone that is now matched Fangio for world championships. And it's kind of incredible. Now, the one thing that Fangio has on just about everybody that I don't think anyone will ever match is ratio win ratios to races entered. That's just a staggering figure that Fangio pulled off. But the fact that Hamilton is ahead of Schumacher in pole positions, not an inconceivable distance away from Schumacher in terms of race wins, considering Hamilton's age, and now has matched Fangio for championships. I mean, the stats are just getting otherworldly.
I'm not always comfortable talking about intergenerational statistics, honestly. I mean, you know, you're right.
Well, hold on. Do you want me to talk about them some more? I'm very comfortable. I have no problem whatsoever.
I always thought Hamilton was pretty on the mark when he talked about, you know, okay, he'd matched Fangio's title count. But, you know, it was a different era, different level of danger, different, you know, a whole different world of racing. I mean, you know, I love it. People who complain about team orders these days. I mean, back in the day, Fangio would take over somebody else's car, you know, and go on and win the race. I mean, it's just a different era of the sport entirely.
Oh, it completely is. I apologize for interjecting here, but there's absolutely one thing after another. The team orders was a totally different standard back then. Cars broke down all the time, which changed things. Like, so were it not for DNFs, that would have played a much bigger factor. The number of races run, that would have played a big factor. There's just countless things you can look to, big arching things that would have changed the dynamics of it. But the fact is, these numbers are numbers, and they're the things that are easiest to remember, and people tend to remember them.
Yeah, I agree. But someone was talking about total points tally, and, you know, they just are still counting the points as they were scored in the day. So, you know, back when you only scored 6 points for a win, you're always going to struggle against someone who's now earning 25 for a win.
I thought it was 9 for a win.
No, it used to be 6, and then they switched it to 9.
Oh, wow. Well, I think it was one point they switched to 8, and then it was 9 for pole position. You got an extra point for pole position or fastest lap or something.
Yeah, and I mean, now obviously you score down to 10th place, whereas before it was only to 6th place. So how can you not? You've either got to recalculate everyone's score based on the current system, right? Or because otherwise it's just pointless tallying those points.
Completely. That's why I like the ratio stats. You know, that's the number that sticks out to me. I mean, it's not 50%, but it is shockingly close to 50%. So half the races that Fangio entered, he won. That's amazing.
Oh, it's incredible. Absolutely. Especially when you think about the level of safety the win, you've read about his win at the Nürburgring where, you know, he came in for a pit stop and they took about 3 minutes to change his tires and he closed down. I think it was the Ferrari drivers of Hawthorne and I forget the other driver's name. But, you know, he was like 2.5 minutes down on them and just broke the lap record on like 3 or 4 successive laps and caught them and won the race. But, you know, you think about those cars and the level of difficulty of the ring and the inclement weather that there usually was. And you know, the danger levels are off the charts. So, no, I mean, I think, you know, they're all great champions in their own right, in their own era. Back in the day, those guys were dealing with risks that, you know, you can't even comprehend to this day. And so, you know, people like him, Clark, I mean, there's just so many legends of the sport back then. It doesn't demean the ones that we have today. It's just a different sport to a certain degree. But, yeah, I remember when I was growing up following F1, you know, and you had the likes of Prost and Senna duking it out, you know, triple world champion still seemed like, you know, an amazing achievement. And that Fangio was always a way off there on 5 championships, and it always looked to be uncatchable. And then, of course, Schumacher redefined a lot about what's possible in the modern Formula One with such a long career and so much sustained success. But, yeah, it's incredible that, you know, Hamilton's managed to match it, especially when he went through that fallow period for a long period after his first championship before he won his second. And a lot of people were criticizing his decision to leave McLaren and move to Mercedes. And here he is, 4 championships out of 5 with, you know, just... And I think definitely his best championship win this year. I mean, of the 5, it stood out. He's really excelled at times. And
yeah,
gone to
definitely.
Another
I mean,
level.
This was the most formidable opponent in many, many ways. And
even Rosberg
absolutely
was impressed.
Yeah, no, but again, you know, Schumacher, he had that period as well. You know, he won his first 2 championships with Benetton, and then he had to wait 4 or 5 years before he had that run with Ferrari, you know, dealing with Mika Hakkinen and getting the car up to speed and all that. But again, in the Schumacher era, they also had effectively unlimited testing, and I feel like that was one of Schumacher's strengths. Is just his relentless, studious, just incredible amount of testing. And then also Ferrari's budget played a role there. So, you know, there's always different factors that play a bigger role than people want to admit in these types of things.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and the fact that, I mean, the one thing that stands out for me, if you compare Schumacher and Hamilton, is that Hamilton has never requested out and out number one status in the team. And he's always been comfortable enough to say, look, you know, I'll put anyone else you want in the other seat and I'll beat them. Most of the times that's worked out. Button ran him pretty close when they were together at McLaren. And obviously Rosberg got the better of him in 16. You know, Schumacher, you go back to, you know, when he was, not so much his early days at Benetton, but certainly in his later seasons and then through most of the Ferrari career, he had preferential treatment, no doubt about it. That's the way he wanted it. That's the way he set it up. And that's one of the keys to his success. And, you know, it's just one of the, he was an incredible racing driver too. But, you know, that was one of the reasons why he was able to go on such a prolonged period of success. Now, you know, Hamilton's approach has been a bit different, and it's been good to see that in my mind.
Yeah, no, totally agree. And I think even just to say it, you know, kind of flippantly, Hamilton's haters even had to tip their hat, you know, at the performance. I mean, it was really genuinely outstanding. I'm going to twist the knife just a tiny bit, though, and say, so was that Valtteri Bottas move first to second really necessary, Chris? Couple Grand Prix ago where
I think he was gifted the win? I think it just increased the pressure on Vettel. So I think, you know, you're right. Now we look back, it would be quite easy to say that that was a mistake and that they should have allowed Bottas to take the win. And
it was very easy to say. I could say it again with no trouble.
But I think it hastened the cracking of Mr. Vettel, and so worked perfectly. Do it again next season.
I think the cracking of Vettel really happened in Germany. Honestly, I mean, if you look at the championship, to me, that was when everything shifted around. And, you know, we had the Belgian Grand Prix where it was like, okay, maybe this will be a good fight yet. And then Italy happened and it was like, oh, no, we're definitely, I mean, Hamilton, we can say now, was on a glide path. And it was certainly Hamilton's incredible performance that brought us there, but it was also Vettel just making one mistake after an, I mean, it was always just, why did you keep doing these? It seems so unnecessary. If he had just dialed it back just the tiniest bit, there would have been so many opportunities to have collected more points and make this a much tighter championship.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. Germany was a big point in the season, absolutely, to you know, crash out of the lead of his home Grand Prix and thus making it easier for Hamilton to come up back through the order and win was a massive turning point. But I think Singapore was pretty definitive too. I mean, for weeks prior to Singapore, Mercedes had been saying, you know, this is going to be a, you know, we know it's a bogey track, we're going to struggle there, we need to make as many points as we can before, you know, the pendulum swings in Singapore. So we rock up, and who sticks it on pole by an enormous margin and romps off into the distance? Nobody expected that, and I think that was the final death knell for Vettel, because, you know, I'm sure he was always thinking in the back of his mind, doesn't matter that I've lost these points here and there, I can make them up, you know, in Singapore, and I'll be right back in it. And instead, he lost more ground.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So Japan was a great race because Suzuka is such an epic track. And just as you'd kind of hinted at earlier, you know, the qualifying was quite fascinating because of the rain that came right in the middle of Q3. And it was a strategy call that Mercedes got their guys out to get a decent run on dry tires, and Ferrari made the mistake of going out on inters to start, and that ended up effectively costing them. The race was still good, but other than following Vettel's mistakes, it wasn't the best Japanese Grand Prix.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't really a nail biter, was it? But it was. I mean, there was some entertaining racing going on. I mean, the Haas maneuver of Magnussen's raised a few eyebrows, didn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So,
and there was some passing, and I mean, it seems so long ago, to be honest, I can barely remember it.
Well,
I mean, the thing I really want to
talk
about
that later in the show. Fault that it has been so long ago. I apologize for that. I should mention.
I think there's a really more important subject we need to talk about, though, which is I was watching the Austin Grand Prix, and as per usual, Daniel Ricciardo retires, right? We all know that's going to happen at some point in the race. And I see him get out of his car, and I hadn't seen the Red Bull drivers not in their car prior to that moment. And I was utterly shocked by the race suit. For a moment, I thought he was wearing cowboy boots.
Oh, yeah. No, that was... Listen, when it comes to marketing and getting and PR, Red Bull is hard to beat. You know, they had the big belt buckle, the kind of like the classic shirt. And yeah, of course, the boots, quote unquote, all designed in the racing suit. No, it was a clever move. And then, of course... Ricardo puts on his faux Southern accent. And yeah, those guys are entertaining.
So I was reading that Daniel was so upset about having another DNF that, he was just thinking about binning off the last couple of races of the season. Honestly, the turning point for me would have been seeing that race suit before Austin, and I would have said, nah, thanks, I'm going to Renault early.
Yeah, listen, it could be a coincidence, but it is getting harder and harder to believe that it's coincidence because Max Verstappen has been doing quite, quite well. I mean, he was third in Japan, he was second in the U.S., and then he won in Mexico. So you compare that to Daniel Ricciardo's performance, and I don't mean he himself, I mean the car, it's laughable. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's extraordinary. It's as ridiculous as the Rosberg-Hamilton series of reliability, right? I mean, it's probably a little bit worse than that, but
it's one of those, but
remember that. I mean, at that season, anything that went wrong with the Mercedes was Hamilton, and there were six Mercedes in on the F1 grid, and it was always Hamilton's for a while. And, you know, it's the same with the Renault. It's always Ricciardo's. Now, I guess the most recent one was a clutch, so they couldn't even blame that one on Renault. But it does appear to be just anything that can go wrong only goes wrong with his car. And you know, it's a shame for him because it did look like it was going to be, you know, a good race, especially in Mexico, because the Red Bulls were so strong there. But you have to give a lot of credit to Max. His driving has been exemplary. For the last few Grand Prix, and there's a lot of people talking up his chances for next season. Of course, that does rather depend on Honda, but yeah, I mean, it's looking good. I mean, certainly Red Bull still have a pretty decent chassis.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I'm going to say this, and I already know that you're going to be biting your tongue a little bit here, but Honda's, they will be great. I don't know when. I'm not giving a deadline, but they will be relentless and they will eventually figure it out. And it will at one point be the strongest engine in the field. I just don't know when it will be, but they will not give up. They will run out of money and shut down, or they will do it.
The third generation Verstappen should be rubbing his hands with glee then.
Well, listen, it happens when it happens. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was interesting. It was Japan, and the qualifying performance of the STRs was very strong. I think it was sixth and seventh on the grid, vaguely, sounds about right, somewhere in the middle of the top 10 anyway. And everyone was super excited and said, oh, Honda has really made a leap. And then the race came along and didn't go so well. I don't even think they scored the points, did they? So
they were sixth and seventh. Although part of that also was the rain. They were one of the ones that got the tire strategy right.
Right, right. But then their finishing, I can't remember, was 11th or something, 11th and lower than that, I believe. So yeah, it would. Yeah. You know, they're still having a few false dawns, I think. They're definitely better than they were. I mean, someone made the comment that they, you know, great improvement over the last few seasons. Rubbish. It's been this season. They were awful for three seasons with McLaren, no doubt about it. But they definitely turned a corner last winter, and they have for sure improved. And obviously, you know, we know that the McLaren chassis wasn't as good as certainly McLaren thought it was. So, you know, part of any performance gains, I guess, would have been masked. But their unreliability in the first couple of seasons was just awful as well. You remember, it was like every three races they would have to have a new engine. And yeah. The McLarens were always...
It wasn't great. I'll admit that.
But, yeah, I mean, they're definitely on an upward trajectory. I think the problem for them is that the relentless pace of progress at the front of the grid. I mean, the gulf between the top three teams and the rest is massive. I mean, it is massive. And so, but... Is it massive enough to overcome a Honda engine? That's what we'll find out next season.
All right. I've been patient. I've been an adult here. I've been. This has been so hard. Let's talk about Kimi's win. It was great. First of all, it was great. Second of all, he was brilliant. Third, Kimi's the best.
I think you said that at the start of the podcast.
Do you want to just interject
that every 10 minutes?
No, that was months ago. So. Here's my prediction.
Oh, okay.
Sauber is now going to be a championship contender because of Kimi Raikkonen.
Wow. Yeah, that's sticking your neck out. All right, good. Well, I'm quite happy to make the bet now, Robert. What's it going to be?
Let's see. Okay, if I win, you have to buy me three gin and tonics and top shelf gin. I get to pick.
What about a Kimi Raikkonen fathead?
Yeah, I can't handle that. And and if I lose, you have to buy me two gin and tonics.
Yeah, no, I think
that's the bet. Yeah, work. Deal?
No.
Yeah. I think that's a deal.
So that's how confident you are. I mean, because I was also expecting you to say, you know, championship contenders after the end of round one, so they may fluke a good Australian result and then you can claim the bet victory. I'm afraid not, mate. I mean, Sauber have been a lot better this season, having taken all of Ferrari's technology. Certainly helped, but it's going to be a lovely two season farewell Kimi tour. It's going to be great.
You're assuming he's farewell. I think that after two seasons with Sauber, he'll be back in the Ferrari to replace Vettel and be the second driver to Charles Leclerc, and that Kimi will be the first driver in decades to race well into his 40s. That's my prediction.
So I was just thinking about that. So who was the last 40-something F1 driver? I know Mansell made it into his 40s, but there must have been someone more recent than that. Was Barrichello in his 40s?
Oh, no.
Or was Barrichello always 25? I forget.
Yeah, I think Barrichello was like 39 or something. But yeah, okay. I think Mansell was the first one I thought of. I mean, how old was... now his name's escaping me. Crap. Italian driver... Oh, yeah.
Not Fisichella.
No. Older than
Cesaris.
Nope, still no. He's like...
Arnoux.
It'll come to me.
He's French. Sorry, I got a little off track there.
Yeah, how old was Jarno Trulli?
He was most ages at some point. I don't know what age he was when he retired.
He definitely acted old. I know that there were a couple of times that he was very much like the guy on the front porch saying, "Get off my lawn."
I always think of Mansell as the elder statesman because he was the one with the wife and the kids who used to go golfing, whereas everyone else was having a playboy lifestyle and having a good time.
Yeah, no.
Mansell seemed to make Formula One dreary.
Mansell had to be well into his 40s, but I think this is obviously going back way far, but wasn't Fangio well into his 40s?
Oh, yeah, Fangio was 50s.
Yeah,
he didn't start racing until he was in his 40s. He was a complete legend. Yeah, the history of Fangio, if no one listening has ever looked it up, is fascinating. Definitely, he is a guy you want to read about. Absolute legend. You know, he was just a supernatural talent in behind the wheel. No doubt about it. So definitely worth reading about him.
Jarno Trulli is 44 years old today. And let's see, when was his last Grand Prix? I think it's been 5 years, so I think he was in his 30s.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's one to ponder, and we'll have to give the answer to the listeners next podcast, which could be halfway through next season, of course.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
You'd be doing anything interesting then, Robin, and what's your excuse to be missing out on Formula One pods?
Oh, we're going to get to that. Trust me. Okay. No, I do. I genuinely have something interesting that is even Formula One related. To talk about my day job, but I do want to talk a little bit more about the Mexican Grand Prix. Obviously, it was the deciding Grand Prix for the championship, and obviously it was to great fanfare and all these things, but I want to talk about the event itself. They did a lot of interesting things. They had the Day of the Dead theme going on strong there, even though it wasn't technically. And they had immediately after the podium ceremony, they had a DJ come on. They had a lot of interesting things go on.
Yeah, but the DJ was awful. Did you hear some of that at the end? They were trying to interview some of the Sky correspondents, and he was...
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't great. It had its moments, but yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I think the Mexican Grand Prix looks like a great, great time. I'm looking forward to putting that on my bucket list, actually. Looks like a good laugh. Looks like... good racing, different winner. They seem to want to really try and entertain the crowd. I quite like those little picnic tables they have through the baseball complex. I don't know how much they cost. It can't be expensive, surely. You could just hang out there, drink beer, and watch Formula One up close.
Yeah, and tacos. Don't forget about tacos.
Oh, tacos, yeah. Dos Equis. Sounds good, because I have to say, I was toying with the idea of going to Austin. And I was in Austin in 2015 when it rained, like monsoon levels all weekend. It was awful. And I was thinking to myself when I was weighing it up this year, whether it could possibly be that bad again. Well, apparently it was. So what is it with Austin and the weather? Because I think it's pretty nice and hot and sunny most of the year until F1 rocks into town and then the rain turns up.
It was great when I was there. The first year I was there and the weather was fantastic. It was sunny in 70s. Okay, so maybe it's me not being there. Maybe that's the ticket.
I got you. Yeah, so, I mean, where would you put Mexico on your all-time F1 want-to-go-to race list?
Oh, top half.
Top half. Okay, so that's like top 14 now, whatever.
I am right. It's up there. I'd say it's pretty high. It's slightly less exotic to me because it's close. You know, there is that kind of like, having real distance to travel to see. I mean, honestly, Spa and Suzuka are so far and above everything else that, you know, I don't know.
You got to put Monaco, Monza in there as well, I think.
Agree with both of those. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then obviously I'm partial to Silverstone, so that would probably be my top five.
Yeah, Silverstone, it's the problem with Silverstone, it's just been so distilled and diluted of its original character that it's harder to, like, really enjoy the essence of, like, Silverstone 20 years ago, absolutely. But it just keeps getting redone and just kind of, like, homogenized and just sterilized. I don't know. It's losing its luster.
You say that, but I actually started going to Silverstone in one of its earlier forms, when you still had the characteristic appearance of a peripheral road around the two main runways, right? So this is before all the reprofiling between Stowe and Club, and obviously the new, this was the old pits complex up at between Woodcote and Copse, and it was even the old Beckett's, right? But through some of its transformations, they've created some fantastic corners. I mean, the Beckett's complex now is one of the great series of corners on any F1 track anywhere, I think. And it was so good that they put it into Austin, which is just as good there, to be fair. It's still a great sequence of corners. It works in Texas as it does in Northamptonshire. And but, you know, they've sort of lost some great corners along the way, too, because I remember Bridge. Did you ever, you remember Silverstone when they had Bridge Corner? So you used to go out of Club, you'd take a left-hand kink at, and then you'd go under this bridge, funny enough, and there would be a right-hander. And I remember watching the F1 cars go through there, and I actually raced on that corner, and it's just an epic, epic bend. So they lost that when they created its current even more convoluted configuration. But I think the thing about Silverstone is the history. You know, it's been going since the 50s, and you've got so many teams based in that area, and you've got a pretty fanatical, you know, fan base that fill the place up, which is, you know, a little bit like Monza. I mean, I think part of the appeal of Monza is its history and the fact that you've got the Tifosi who are rampantly, you know, supporting Ferrari. And I think that's what, you know, makes the experience as much as the track layout itself, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm with you. And yeah, I think that were I at Silverstone and were able to somehow con someone to give me a cup of ice a few minutes after I got my hot tea.
Yeah, good luck with that, mate.
I could be convinced that, yeah, I'm sure I would absolutely love it. I'm absolutely sure.
So Silverstone has two temperature settings. If you haven't been, it's well worth knowing this. It's either always cold or it's roasting hot. There's no in between. So you either
get... Yeah, but roasting hot is like low 70s in England.
No,
like
no. There's something weird. It's got a microclimate. I mean, it can be hotter than anything I've experienced. And you always see people drunk and sunburned at Silverstone for some reason.
Well, okay, fine. I mean, they don't believe in sunscreen in England. That's fine. That's fair. But I don't know. Like, just to give a teaser, the place that I want to talk about in the near future was Bahrain. And something tells me it gets warmer in Bahrain than it does in Silverstone. That's just a guess.
I think you're probably on safe ground, apart from like 2 days a year, or maybe even 2 days every 5 years. Then Silverstone somehow just gets it, and that'll be the day that you go there without sunscreen.
Okay, and it'll be 45 degrees Celsius or something. I'll be like, well, no kidding. How about that? So the driver I was thinking of is in fact French, is Jean Alesi. And
of course,
he has Italian roots, does he not? I mean, his name is Giovanni. That's his full name.
Yeah, he was a French Sicilian, I believe.
Ah, there it is. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, he was like 36 when he retired. So no, also not in his 40s.
Okay, good. Well, I did like Jean. He was quite the character. He did turn up for the Grand Prix recently, didn't he? Did he do the post-race interviews?
Yeah, not that long ago. That's right. I mean, these days it's been largely, you know, Sky or BBC, you know, David Coulthard or...
Yeah, I have to say that's controversial, isn't it? I'm not wild about that. As much as I respect those guys as pundits, and I do think they do a good job for Sky, you've got to have a local geezer up there on the rostrum. You know, I think that's part and parcel of... I guess the trouble is there's so many Grand Prix that have no Grand Prix history anymore that it becomes challenging. But I do like seeing ex-F1 drivers of all nationalities give post-race interviews. I think that adds a lot more to the discussion, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I can't argue with that. Now, we've discussed in kind of haphazard form the three races and obviously the championship. Is there anything you want to talk about this season as a whole? And, you know, there's a lot of talk about changes to Formula One in the future, going on the silly season, stuff like that. I know there's two Grand Prix left yet, but do you have any thoughts now that the championship is decided that you want to touch on now?
Well, I think the big thing is, if we look at the driver's market, right, there is a bit of a changing of the guard, despite Kimi still driving for Sauber next year. We've got, I thought it was a brave move by Williams to promote George Russell, despite, you know, there appearing to be some pressure from Mercedes to take Ocon.
Yeah, I agree with you. I was happy about that.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess they haven't announced a second driver. It could still be Ocon, but we shall see. I think we both know who we'd prefer to see in the other seat. yes. But yeah, I think there's some exciting drivers coming up that aren't, you know, pay drivers necessarily. These are guys who've shown good form in the lower formulae and probably have their crack at the sport. I mean, it's interesting that Stoffel Vandoorne's had to be pushed out, which is shocking to me. I thought he would be around for a while. But I am excited. I think, you know, it is important that we see young drivers get a fair crack at the whip and come into the sport. And I'm very excited to see how Ferrari is going to go next year with Charles Leclerc, because he has shown so much promise this season. And the same with Gasly in the Red Bull. It's going to be great to see those guys go head to head with two of the, you know, modern day top level drivers.
Well, it's funny, because the thing I want to mention is the exact opposite of what you're talking about. I am getting quite concerned for Carlos Sainz in the McLaren. And I hope that he doesn't kind of get lost in the ether of just a McLaren that refuses to start to perform again.
Yeah, it's interesting how his career's developed, isn't it? Because he was so competitive with Max, and you know, Max got the promotion and Sainz didn't, and his career has sort of been drifting laterally ever since. You've got to believe that McLaren are going to be better next season. You have to believe that. If they're not, it will be truly astonishing. So, you know, if he's got a decent midfield car, I think he'll be in good shape. Why are you expecting McLaren to have the world's slowest car again?
Well, because what I've seen is that McLaren is suffering from hubris that is really hard to cure. And, you know,
a year ago. They can't possibly still be now, can they?
Well, that's just it. I mean, I don't see, certainly not publicly, a lot of forward-facing of, oh boy, we really got to get our stuff together here. Williams, you know, they're also a very sad state of affairs. It was just announced today that, yet again, his name's escaping me. The race engineer, the lead race engineer, he was Moss's guy. Look? No.
Jock Clear?
No. It's Rob Smedley.
Oh, Smedley, yeah.
You know, he's leaving Williams. He's leaving Formula One altogether. I'm still more hopeful for Williams to have a turnaround, just because I love Williams so much, than McLaren. But of course, I want McLaren to turn around as well. But boy, maybe they're having a little bit more of a, we've got to get our act together. But that doesn't mean they're going to. I mean, you know, Sauber's had a lot of momentum. Renault obviously has a lot of momentum going in their direction. They're going to have two very strong drivers. Of course, Mercedes is still going to be there. Red Bull's going to be competitive. Ferrari. So all of a sudden, we're getting into the mid-pack already. You know, and, you know, is Force India going to be that bad? I don't think so. You know, so where do these teams end up in that case? And where is Sainz going to be in that scenario? And also, if Sainz is, I mean, McLaren, who's going to be the lead development driver at McLaren?
Well, it's got to be him, isn't it?
Right. It's not going to be Lando. No. And is Sainz experienced? Yeah, some. But what has he got? 3 or 4 seasons? Not 10. You know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I do. But I think it's different having a driver
who's been in two different F1 teams, who's got four seasons under his belt, than having two rookies or you know, a rookie and a half, which is the Stroll and Sorokin deal at Williams. I mean, don't get me started about that.
Yeah, God.
That was a disastrous decision for driver lineup. And they've made so many errors. I mean, I think the good thing about Sainz is that if it doesn't go well, he could just go rallying and he could keep doing that into his 50s. So I think he's fine.
Oh, I'm not worried about Carlos Sainz Jr. putting food on the table. That's not my concern. I think he's someone that has real potential, and I'd hate to see it wither away.
Yeah, I'd like to think that you're not going to have your career die by driving and signing for McLaren. I do not believe that McLaren will continue to be in this lull for years to come. I don't think next year they're going to be at the front, but I think they'll make a decent step forward, and I believe Williams will do so too. Because at the end of the day, right, you know, there's a lot of discussion that the primary, certainly the Ferrari, Mercedes and Red Bulls are, you know, we know they're at a different level. Their operations are much bigger. They got much bigger budgets. But the fact that you've got the likes of Force India still able to mix it at the lead of the mid-pack suggests to me that it just comes back down to good old-fashioned engineering excellence, right? If you get your processes in order, you know what you're doing about the vehicle concept and the design of the aero, and you develop a good chassis, you can still make a quick enough car to score points on a regular basis. And Williams and McLaren have got amazing facilities, and they've got a long, illustrious history of being able to do that. And for whatever reason, they've lost their way, but I got to believe they can put it right. It's not like they're the Minardi or, you know, LaRousse of the modern Formula One era, are they? I mean, there were some real duds back in the day where there's just complete no-hoper teams, and you knew they were always going to be awful until they basically just disappeared. Then it's different these days.
Well, Minardi's still with us, just with a different name. Toro Rosso with the Honda, and that Honda power is pulling them forward. That is a good point.
Well, the current championship dominating team used to be BAR Honda, which was a dog of a chassis for so long. They actually started to think that the place was cursed because they couldn't win for so long.
Well, hold on. After there was a moment they were BAR Honda, but then they were Honda Racing. Yep. And in 2006, they had a win with Jenson Button, and they were pretty strong in the mid-noughts. And then, yeah, it didn't go so well after that, but, you know, whatever.
Well, then they became Braun, and their fortunes turned for good, forever.
Yes.
It seems.
Forever. But, okay, so just... So first and foremost, I just want to say I'm sorry that it's been these long lulls in between podcasts. It's been ultimately just my own weakness, and I should have put more effort in. And so first and foremost, I want to apologize. That being said, when we did the last podcast, I had just come back from Japan.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, and I know, woe is me.
Is it Japan, Ohio, is it?
Kind of, sort of. It was for the 2019 Acura NSX drive, and that is a car that had a lot of engineering done in Ohio. But we were in northern Japan to try the refresh car, and it was not the weekend of the Grand Prix, sadly, but it was an excellent event. But then, you know, I had travel almost every week in October, and that ended with a trip to Bahrain to drive a Porsche Panamera GTS. And that article is on autoweek.com. And part of that drive was lapping the Bahrain International Circuit. So lapping the same track that the Formula One cars run, and we did it during the day and at night. They have a lighting system to run at night, and it was quite interesting to be on that track and experience it from the driver's seat after having only seen it on television.
Is it more interesting behind the wheel? Because I've never liked that track. I always get lost halfway around. It's like they finished the lap or started a new one. Just there was one corner that always used to be a potential overtaking corner. Otherwise, it was just dreary. But anyway, was it a fun track?
Yeah, it's really not bad. I mean, by F1 track standards, it's not amazing. So that one to go back to an earlier reference would be in the bottom half of forming the tracks to go to. But, you know, as a track on its own, you know, it's pretty impressive. It's fairly flat around the circumference of it, but then there's this kind of like middle infield section. And there's some rising, you know, blind turn-ins and some places where the car can get pretty unsettled and some parts that are a little bit off camber. And, so, you know, it's an interesting track. It's a solid place to be. And Bahrain as a place in general is a beautiful place. I mean, I think Bahrain is a very beautiful part of the Middle East, and I like that part quite a lot. And the track is, you know, there's too many slow corners to be a proper Formula One circuit, but the infield is interesting. There are places where a car can get unsettled. And to drive a big Porsche sedan around there, that was plenty interesting.
So how did it work then? Did they just let you loose in the car, or did you go out with an experienced driver and then you got a go, how does the format?
It's pretty common on these media drives. There are occasions where you're let to go out on your own. I drove a Ferrari around Fiorano on my own. Left alone, that was a very special treat. But usually the way it works is it's lead follow, and you have a pro driver in the car in front of you. And so you're on your own in the car, but you're kind of protected in a way by having someone that knows the track well enough, knows the line, and they basically allow you to go as fast as you want. But...
So are you ever tempted to do a Daniel Ricciardo impersonation and lick the stamp and send it down the inside of the pro driver like turn two?
You know, it's one of those things. I do want to be invited to these trips again. And so letting Porsche know you're going to send it, that's one thing. Maybe I'll do that the day before I retire.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it sounds like you've been having a lot of fun, mate. Excellent.
Well,
I've been moving house. It's not been quite so entertaining.
Well, yeah, but without knowing the details, sounds like it's an upgrade. So that's exciting in its own right.
Absolutely, we've painted the entire house in a sort of a silver hue with little sort of green flashes here and there.
That's a Mercedes silver. I have no doubts.
Yeah. So. So what else intrigues you? Do you think in two seasons we'll have transformational F1 cars with close racing?
Until we do, I'm going to continue to shout and cheerlead for IndyCar. In two seasons, IndyCar is going to continue to have this much more competitive aerodynamics package, and they're going to have a lot more horsepower.
And Marcus Ericsson.
And they're going to have Marcus Ericsson even sooner than that. Yeah, they're going to have Marcus Ericsson in 2019.
The driver that no one realized was actually in Formula One for the last 2 years is going to be an IndyCar.
Well, it's a bit like Chris Chilton, you know, in a way.
True.
So, yeah, there's a decent number of ex-F1 guys in there, you know, Alexander Rossi, of course. But, you know, we've had this really interesting parallels of just true greats coming out in the series. Lewis Hamilton in Formula One and Scott Dixon in IndyCar. And Scott Dixon's achievements, okay, they're not as high as Lewis Hamilton's, but in the context of where he's raced, it's truly remarkable. And fewer people have pulled off what Scott Dixon pulled off than what Lewis Hamilton pulled off. 'Cause there's only one other driver that had five titles. And in Formula One, there were two.
But I'm confused. So Alonso decides that he's had enough of F1, or the other way around, whichever side you want to look at it. And sadly, he's leaving at the end of the season because he will be sorely missed. There's no doubt about that.
So we all assumed he was going to go and do a season of IndyCar. But no, he's not doing a season of IndyCar. He's just going to do, I think, the 500 again, right? So what's he going to do for the rest of the year? He's going to race sports cars, is he? I mean, he's done that. He won Le Mans.
Well, we are in the middle, quote unquote, of the World Endurance Championship. The World Endurance Championship technically is one super season, although that super season has a pretty darn long break between November and March. But so he'll be doing that, and who knows? I mean, who knows? Maybe he'll end up in NASCAR. I wouldn't be that surprised if something like that happened.
He's going to add the Daytona 500 to his bucket list, is he, so he can then say he's one better than Graham Hill.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That seems to be where he's going these days. So it's a bit sad.
Yeah, definitely so. So we've got Brazil and Abu Dhabi. Yeah, what are you looking for those last two races?
Well, we certainly have a championship alive, right? And Mercedes' form in Mexico was awful. They had a reasonable pace, but they had no longevity of the tyres. Couldn't get them to work. But we've seen that, you know, for all of the top teams at different points for the season. But it's never really been a strong Mercedes track. But there's always possibility of passing there. So hopefully we'll have a good six-way race. Maybe a dash of rain will keep us entertained. So I think we just want a good close fight and see who can win the constructors. Because I definitely think Ferrari have a good chance. I mean, if they have a couple of really strong races and get both cars, you know, on the podium, then they can still nick it, I think.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. And it'll be interesting to see how Force India pulls out at the end. They've been very strong, but then lacking these last few races just a little bit. So, yeah, it could still... There's still a lot to play for other than winning the Drivers' Championship. So, I'm certainly still generally intrigued. And hopefully the Formula One schedule, my travel schedule... will align just a tiny bit better, and we'll be able to talk about it with just a little bit more timeliness.
Yeah, I'm sure there was lots of fascinating things that I've long since forgotten that happened during the race, unfortunately. I mean, so what is the... Where is the other intrigue then? So I don't think there's a big battle in the constructors other than the top two, is there? I mean, what's the battle for fourth place? Do you have that in front of you? So it's between Haas, Renault, and the old Force India combined with the new Force India. I think we're the top candidates for fourth, right?
So we've got Mercedes and Ferrari still battling it out. At the moment, Mercedes does have a 55-point lead. So, but you know what? It doesn't really matter. We're going to keep watching. We're going to watch the last two Grand Prix, and we'll pick apart what happened, and we'll make some importance out of it. That's what matters. But I do want to let everyone know that there is the Brazilian Grand Prix coming up, which is the 20th round on the 11th of November. That's this coming weekend. And the fifth round of the World Endurance Championship will be the six-hour race at Shanghai, and that'll be the 18th of November. And I want to thank you for listening. Please take a moment to review us on iTunes or on whatever platform you get our podcast. Please leave comments on the episode of your choice by going to funwithcars.com. As always, I can be reached at feedback@funwithcars.com. Tweet us at fun_with_cars. And check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/FWCars. Chris, always is a pleasure to talk with you.
And you, Robin. And you.
You had to think about it, though. I'm Robin Warner. Goodbye.
Will, do you want to say something for the podcast listeners? Something about Formula One. Can you say something? What you got to say? Who's your favorite F1 driver?
No. was Hamilton.
And there's no brainwashing on my part there at all. He came to that informed decision all by himself.
Yeah, I'm sure. And Will, are you being handed a 10 or a 20 right now?
I don't need to pay him. I've just over the years he's had.
Oh,
no
is it
hope.
Is it ice cream?
Yeah, it's a little bit like it could be ice cream. I think it's more candy, isn't it?
Well, I'll tell you what, Will Lewis Hamilton's my favorite driver too, Chris. Can I have some ice cream?
So next time you're back from Japan, we'll see if we can hook you up.